Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And we're delighted to have as a guest today, Hanya. Hanya is a pediatric clinician who's on the board of ISAP, as well as being a practicing clinician. So Hanya, can you start by maybe giving us the proper pronunciation of your surname and maybe telling us something of your background?
Hello, everyone. It's really a pleasure to join you today. So the proper pronunciation of my name, Hanya, as you said very nicely, and my surname is Shaevska. I hope it's not that difficult. And as you said, I'm a pediatrician and the chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical University of Warsaw. And my interest is in pediatric nutrition and pediatric gastroenterology. But generally, I'm a pediatrician.
And I'm always curious when I meet clinicians who are interested in probiotic and prebiotic science, because you must have competing demands for your attention from people, you know, trying to get you to use their medications, their drugs, their treatments. What was it that drew you in the first instance to consider even probiotics and prebiotics as a potential intervention for your patients?
Well, I can tell you it started many, many years ago. And as a matter of fact, I'm a member of ESPGHAN, European Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology and Nutrition. And I think when I was a young physician, many, many years ago, I went to one of the meetings. And there was a working group working on acute gastroenteritis, and they did want to do a study on Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. I have never heard before the name, what is Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG? I have never heard the name probiotics, but when they asked, is there anyone from Eastern Europe who would like to contribute? I raised my hand and I said, yes, I want to contribute. And you know, I went back home to Poland. The meeting, I think, was in the U.S., in Houston, a joint meeting with Americans. You know, I went back home and I was starting searching. There was no internet at that time. I was starting searching, what does it mean, this probiotics? What is behind it? What is this Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG? So as you can see, this was not a very usual start. But anyway, it was a beginning of, I would say, maybe not love affair, but romance with microbiota and with probiotics. But it started in very unusual way. But we have done at that time the nice study, one of the first study on Lactobacillus rhamnosus GEG in oral rehydration solution. It was a multi-center study in many European countries. And one of those studies which nicely show that Lactobacillus rhamnosus GEG, if given early, may reduce the duration of acute gastroenteritis.
That's a very interesting story, Hanya, because you've had significant leadership roles in probiotics research and also at ESPGHAN, and you led a review of the evidence for probiotics for many pediatric gastroenterological indications. And ESPGHAN came to a different conclusion with regard to probiotics for acute gastroenteritis than the American Gastroenterological Association's review. Can you talk a little bit about why there may be differences?
Yes, that's true. Our conclusions from ESPGHAN, and we just published this document, ESPGHAN guidelines on the use of probiotics for gastrointestinal disease, they do differ, particularly with regard to the use of probiotics for the management of acute gastroenteritis. But our recommendation for selected probiotics and AGA recommendation is a conditional recommendation. And if you look what is the interpretation of the conditional recommendation, either for or against, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same, and it means that the clinician, based on the discussion with patients, looking at the preferences, you know, can make a decision. So none of the societies is saying you have to use, you should not use it. it's a conditional recommendation. And when I talk to physician, when I talk to pediatrician, I always explain, you should not expect magic. I mean, the true management for acute gastroenteritis is rehydration and proper nutrition. However, you may consider using a probiotics with documented efficacy, and we do have such probiotics, and you can expect that might be reduction in the duration of diarrhea by one day, but it's not a magic bullet. It will not stop. There's no such a treatment, you know, for any disease. So one should have really a realistic expectation when using any kind of medication, including probiotics.
That's really interesting. And when you talk to your medical students, what level of awareness is there even of probiotics? Or is there immediate thought that this is just, you know, advertising and commercial products and has no real value? What sense do you get from your students and colleagues?
Well, the problem is in my country, like in many other European countries, not all of them, but in many, there are hundreds of various probiotic products on the market. I think in my country, it's probably over 100. Italy is another example, probably even more. And unfortunately, many of us, I'm saying healthcare professionals, they do not differentiate, you know, good product with a science behind it, evidence behind it, from products without any kind of evidence behind it. And I always keep saying, it's like, you know, when you are choosing an antibiotic, you would never choose any antibiotic. You would choose a very specific antibiotic for a condition you want to treat. And if you want to have to use a reason in a reasonable way, evidence-based way, the use of probiotics, you have to use the probiotics with documented efficacy in the condition for which it was studied. So it is not easy, I have to say. It's not easy because many of us, unfortunately, and it's all over the world, it's not only in my country, in many countries, that people do not differentiate probiotics. They do differentiate antibiotics, usually, but not probiotics.
I know that in Ireland, at least, you know, this is what I'm told, I mean, there is no formal aspect to the training of a clinician dealing with benefits of microbes or even the microbiome. You know, there's microbiology to a trainee clinician is salmonella and listeria and infection and, you know, the negative parts of microbiology interacting with humans, which of course are many, but there's very little attention to potential beneficial effects. Would that be the same, do you think, in your training?
Yeah, you are absolutely correct. It's very much true. Unfortunately, we are trying to change it. We do, at least in my university, we do try to teach students about microbiota. And there is a lot of interest in lay media, as you know, about microbiota and various ways to modify it. The problem is that the message is not always clear or it's not evidence-based. It's very often market-driven, so we have to be very careful again and again which probiotic to choose and just to teach. The only way we can convince people is just to healthcare professionals, in just to provide evidence. This is the only thing which we can do and allow me to repeat again and again that one should have realistic expectations when it comes to healthcare professionals and also to patients. We cannot tell them that they can expect magic. It's just not doable.
Can you tell Kanya about what you mean by evidence? You've led so many very rigorous studies as well as systematic reviews of such studies.
I'm biased because I really like randomized control trials. And in our department, we have really done a number of randomized control trials with probiotics, also with other interventions, but especially with probiotics. And some of them were positive, which means that we show that the probiotics that we studied was more effective. One of our very recent publications is in JAMA Pediatrics. It's a mixture of various probiotics for prevention of antibiotic-associated diarrhea. Sometimes we just show that it's the same efficacy as placebo. We publish always, no matter whether the results are positive or no results, we always publish the results. We always publish the protocols of the study. And we always publish because I think it's extremely important to have evidence from positive or negative studies that we show that it's probably worse than placebo. So I think the most important is just to rely on high quality evidence.
And Hania, we often get this apparent conflict between evidence and mechanism.
Yes.
And, you know, people often level the accusation at probiotic science, but you don't know the mechanism or you don't have specific mechanisms, and therefore we cannot recommend or we can't kind of take this forward as an intervention. How important do you think is mechanistic understanding of why potentially one strain works and another strain doesn't? And for the other range of medications that you prescribe to your patients, do you always have mechanism?
Well, that's an excellent question. And of course, first of all, what is important for you would like to have both evidence that it works, clinical evidence, and to know exactly what is the mechanism. And of course, for probiotics, like also for other interventions, it's not always that we do have. So then what is important to have clinically important evidence? It's not just statistically significant difference, but something that would be clinically important that I can come to patients and say, look, this is what you can expect. Because again, I think it's important to tell people what you can expect when you use, for example, probiotics without documented efficacy. For acute gastroenteritis, I already mentioned that it's a reduction in the duration of diarrhea by approximately 1 day. For prevention of antibiotic-associated diarrhea, you may say with some probiotics, with documented efficacy, it's reduction by 50%. For colic, you may reduce the duration of crying time, half an hour. You may say, well, is it enough or not? I keep saying, well, you are a parent and you have a or grandfather or grandmother and you have a baby next room, you know, crying, half an hour makes a tremendous difference. If you are sitting in the lecture hall and you are listening to the presentation, you say, well, half an hour, what's the difference? I think these are all these issues that are important. So we would like to have both. But at least, I would say, clinically important, clinical evidence.
But if you see multiple people with a particular condition, then you could probably see a reduction in a group getting the probiotic as opposed to a group not getting the probiotic. But as an individual, you know, who has diarrhea and has it for only 2 days as against 3 days, they don't know that the probiotic save them a day, or they don't know whether it actually increased their, you know, diarrhea from 1 day to two. So at the individual level, it must be hard to convince people, while at your level, looking at groups of people, you can probably see those benefits. But do individuals see the benefits?
Well, I would say in my country, you know, we do have other problems that people are overusing probiotics. They don't ask us. They just go to the pharmacy and they just buy any product. This is a problem because then you may not see the effect because you have just chosen the wrong probiotic. So yes, at the individual level, you may not see it, but this is what we expect from academics, that we know that it will be completely different answer, that based on the well-conducted study, we may say what we can expect. It doesn't mean that every patient would benefit, but at least we can now say, we can say based on number needed to treat, let's say we have to treat 10 patients in order one of them to benefit. We would never say which one of them will benefit, but at least we know how many of them are likely to benefit. So, you know, I really like, as you know, I really like evidence-based medicine. I really think it's important to understand what is the effect size behind any kind of intervention, not only probiotics, any kind of intervention, and just to have a realistic expectation. Do not expect magic.
So there are things you know about evidence-based medicine that some of our audience members don't, and I'd like to illustrate it by asking you, how would you treat a situation where the evidence from one very large randomized controlled trial was in favor of a particular probiotic, and there were two other smaller studies that had statistically ambiguous results that were not statistically significant in favor of the indication? But when you did meta-analyses and pulled the information across the three studies together, you do have a statistically significant effect.
Well, of course, I mean, what is also important, what is how well the studies were done. So it's not just pulling the data from individual studies, but also from the scientific point of view to know what is the risk of bias in those studies. If all of them were, three of them were well conducted, so the poor results give us some answer. If one of those studies is very well done, it's low risk of bias, independently, you know, no industry. I'm not saying that the industry supported study will be bad study. I'm just saying that we really have to know what is a risk of bias.
Right.
And if it's a low risk of bias, well, that's fine. Then I just, if one of them is high risk of bias, well, it's a different story. So we, it's not just looking at pooled data. It's also the interpretation of those pooled data based on the risk of bias, which is important.
That's a great point, but let's assume they're all equally strong in terms of having low risk of bias. I just want to clarify, if you have one study in favor and two against, but the pooled estimate across the three studies is in favor?
I think what is also important, you know, you also look at the details like population. Let's say one of those studies was done in my own population. So this is something that I will also look. So additional information are needed in order to make a conclusion. So this is important for interpretation of the data.
But in general, if you did feel that you could combine the studies with meta-analysis and the meta-analysis supported that there was statistics, yeah, you would consider that evidence in favor.
Generally.
Do you think, Anya, that clinicians are influenced by the fact that, you know, a probiotic potentially is just a food supplement? It's not a pharmaceutical. And so, you know, are clinicians biased in favor of, I'd like to recommend things that come from the pharmacy because I have a much higher confidence in sending someone out and kind of saying, stop at a supermarket on your way home and get a supplement. Do you think that influences the willingness of clinicians to embrace probiotic as an intervention?
I think it's an important point. I'm coming from the country that at least 3 or 4 products are registered as drugs. So, and some of those are also included in the guidelines. So we do have probiotic strains which are registered as a drug. Yes, it adds to the, because the quality of the product is important. And we do have data that quality of the probiotic product, especially food supplements, is not always ideal. In some subgroup of population, it has a tremendous, tremendous importance, like preterm infants. We really have to be sure that we are giving the product of not only high quality, of the highest quality. So yes, I do think it matters. And in many countries, including my own, but also in other, we do have reports that the quality of the probiotic product is sometimes questionable. Unfortunately, as a consumer, as a buyer, I don't know which product is that, you know, I cannot check it. So it would be nice to have some kind of independent quality control. Within the ESPGAL, we publish a call for more stringent quality control. But, you know, the scientific society, all we can do is just to publish such a report. We don't have tools, you know, to implement it. So we rely on third parties.
Can you clarify what you mean by, as a consumer, you can't check it?
I'm saying, like, for example, as a physician, I prescribe it to the patient. I say,
like you prescribe a specific strain at a particular...
Of course, as a physician, I would prescribe a specific strain. I would never say just buy any kind of probiotic.
Right.
That's absolutely for sure. But this is, of course, I would say in a privileged position that I know all these studies by heart sometimes.
Yes.
So it's easier for me.
Do you ever have concerns, Hanya, particularly with the patient group that you deal with? You know, very vulnerable patients, of putting a live microbe in a situation where, you know, the patient may well be compromised in some way, immunologically or a barrier effect compromised. Does that ever give you pause for thought, or does it mean certain patient groups you just simply wouldn't give a probiotic to?
Yes, definitely. They are certain that we have to outweigh the benefits and risks. I would say all these patients in the intensive care units with central catheters. I mean, this is a high-risk population. And for example, for some of the probiotics, it's even contraindication to use it. And it's clearly stated by the manufacturers. One of these vulnerable groups are preterm infants. I'm not neonatologist, but by myself. But every now and then, because of my interest in probiotics, I'm invited by neonatologists to contribute to all the discussion. And this is a true concern. In our ESPGAN document, we clearly stated that for preterm infants, you really need to have a high-quality product. Your laboratory in the hospital has to be aware which products in preterm infants you are using, that in case sepsis or anything, you can also culture for those microorganisms. So, you know, there's a number of precautions when you use probiotics in a certain high-risk population that has to be followed. And this is really crucial. some vulnerable population, there is a risk potential. I'm not saying high risk, but there is potential risk, and we do have such reports from the literature. However, having said that, I mean, safety in otherwise a healthy population, we know that probiotics are very safe. But high risk population, there is some risk. So we have to be careful.
Anya, I wonder how you feel as somebody who's familiar with situations where specific probiotics work and work dramatically, as well as places where they don't seem to work, indications where they don't work. How do you feel about those broadside type publications that come out in both the medical literature and in the lay press that just treat probiotics as a class, especially when they just condemn them as not effective?
Yeah, but then it's again, I mean, for us as academics, it's really important to clarify as much as possible, you know, how to interpret the data, how to look into the data, not to pull all the probiotics together. And this is again, like when we are speaking about antibiotics, everyone knows that not all antibiotics are the same, that each one of them works differently and is for different conditions. And the only thing we can do is to repeat it again and again. Not all probiotics are the same, and each one of them has to be evaluated separately when it comes to safety and efficacy, because both are equally important.
My colleague here, Fergus Shannon, and I think you know Fergus over the years, he used to always kind of illustrate that dilemma by saying, you know, if a doctor was asked, do pills work for headaches? They would say, well, which pill are you talking about?
Exactly.
You know, but for probiotics, people just say, do probiotics work for something? And they expect a yes or a no answer. And why they can't kind of grasp that it's an equally complex question in both cases was always beyond him. But I always like that. Do pills work? How would you answer that, yes or no? You know, when you're meeting colleagues who are prescribing probiotics, recommending probiotics, what do you think has influenced them most? Is it the building up of evidence, or do you think it's their own personal experience of how their patients fare? What do you think is a more compelling thing for a clinician?
Well, there are many factors. I should say one of them, when you talk to patient, is also the cost of the product. So, and it makes a difference for patients. So every now and then it's easier, you know, it's an extra treatment. It's not a necessity for any of the condition. It's not like a must. Rehydration in diarrhea, it's a must, but a probiotic is just an additional treatment. So I think the cost of the product for many families will have a tremendous impact. Of course, media, as you hear on the media, a lot of information, so marketing. And marketing sometimes is very successful in the way every now and then, like probably like you, I'm surprised, a product with fantastic evidence behind it are not so well promoted or marketed as a product with hardly any evidence, but marketing is really doing fantastic job. So these factors will definitely contribute. And last but not least, of course, it's knowledge. I mean, how well educated people are. And as I think you said at the beginning, I mean, probiotics, it's not the major topic of interest or what we teach students. There are many other things which are definitely more important. However, patients are spending money on that. So it's really important, if we prescribe something, let's prescribe something that is at least potentially will be effective. I'm very tough when it comes to it. I think it's unethical to prescribe patients, I'm speaking from the position of a physician, to prescribe drugs that do not have any evidence behind it. I mean, patients can do whatever they want, but we as physician, we should never prescribe something that there is no evidence behind it.
Anya, you said something intriguing, that you believe that the probiotics, when there is good evidence for them, that it's sort of an optional treatment. Mm-hmm. I'd like what your assessment is. Do you mean that also even for the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, where there's evidence for prevention of NEC and perhaps sepsis?
Yeah, prevention of necrotizing. And here we are not speaking about the reduction one day of duration of diarrhea or anything. We are speaking about that death or life condition, because necrotizing enterocolitis may occur up to, let's say, 20, in some setting, up to 20% of preterm infants. If you work in a setting with a very high baseline risk of necrotizing enterocolitis, I would definitely consider using the probiotic with documented efficacy and, you know, with the product which is safe. for settings with a very low baseline risk, that's probably another discussion. This is a kind of discussion that I'm involved every now and then in my country, in some of my colleagues from neonatology unit. If we do have such a very low risk, do we really need to use it? That's a difficult question, but I keep saying, I mean, if there is, the potential is always, I mean, even if it's only 5%, it means some of the infants will get it. And from the point of view of parents, this is the only child. It's not one of many. I mean, this is the only child. And people would expect you, parents would expect that you would do in your neonatal unit whatever is possible to reduce even this small risk. Sometimes in preterm infants, people are waiting, you know, there's a lot of efforts to get pregnant, to have a child. So there are very sensitive issues. So if there's a good evidence behind, a good quality product, I would go for it.
I think that's a great place to leave it. I think in that answer, you demonstrated both scientific rigor and empathy for parents and your patients. And that's a wonderful collection of qualities to have. So thank you so much for sharing with us today. I think we both really enjoyed it. And thank you for all the work you've done for probiotics over the years. We really do appreciate it.
I always love talking to you, Anya. I always learn whenever I talk to you.
Thanks a lot. It was really a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks a lot.